there was one question about the place of women. Let me just scroll back to make sure I get to it. Can you address the schism that is represented by Women of the Wall and the division between liberal and Orthodox Jews in Israel? Wow. That is quite a question. We could probably have a whole webinar just on, webinar 10 just on that. But the Women of the Wall are very interesting, particularly because they were started as a halachic, feminist Orthodox group of women that just wanted to do women's prayer together at the Kotel. And they believed that was within the confines of Orthodox halacha. Over the years, you know, different women joined them, some associated with conservative, some associated with reform, some associated with secular Judaism. So even among the Women of the Wall, there's some division now about what their goals are. Do they want an egalitarian section of the Kotel? Do they want a section just for women's prayer? I encourage you to Google a little bit. The latest news about the pluralistic section at the Kotel or outside of the Kotel, a compromise offered by Natan Sharansky. One thing that is interesting to note is most Israelis, most secular Israelis, don't care about Women of the Wall, or at least didn't care about Women of the Wall until recently. And it's sad to admit, because most Israelis really could care less about where they pray at the Kotel. You know, Israelis have kind of taken for granted that the religious institutions are run by the Orthodox. It's kind of like what we call secular Orthodox Jews, right? I don't go to synagogue, but the synagogue that I don't go to is Orthodox. I don't go to the Kotel, but it's good that the Kotel has a mechitza because that's the way a synagogue should be. One of the things that we're trying to do, and I think Women of the Wall are trying to do, are to challenge the notions that have been taken for granted for years in Israeli society. A lot of people talk about the Orthodox, complain about the Orthodox monopoly in Israel. The Orthodox have a monopoly on the Kotel. The Orthodox have a monopoly on marriage and divorce in Israel. The Orthodox have a monopoly on funding for religious institutions in Israel. And it's true, and it's a problem. But we can't just blame the Orthodox for that. We as secular, liberal, pluralistic, non-Orthodox Jews in Israel and outside of Israel are also to blame. But I think especially Jews in Israel, I like to say we sold our stocks in Judaism. We said, we're not really interested in this. You guys want it, you take care of it. But now secular Jews and pluralistic Jews are trying to buy back their stocks in Judaism and reclaim Judaism. And I think that's why, you know, for dozens of years, Women of the Wall was, you know, a handful of women. And now, over the past couple of years, since there's people in Israel want the status quo to change, I think a lot of it has to do with the social justice protests that happened two summers ago in Israel and the new elections in Israel, that a lot of things that have been taken for granted in Israel, now in the past couple of years, Israelis are saying, no, enough. We want to change what it means to be a Jewish and democratic state in Israel. So that's kind of on one foot. But one thing that's a very prominent issue in the tension between the pluralistic organizations in Israel and, I'll say, the ultra-Orthodox establishment in Israel is the issue of women and the place of women in the army, in society. Those of us in the pluralistic Jewish world, including many modern Orthodox organizations, if there's anything we do insist upon, it's equality for the place of women in Judaism, in religion and culture. So we have about 10 minutes left. I think that's enough time to give a little bit of a taste of learning because, you know, I do come from the secular yeshiva, so it's great to talk about history, I think. So it's also nice to do a little bit of traditional yeshiva study, and I think the two go hand in hand. And then we can have a little more time for questions and discussion at the end. So this is a story. Some of you might be familiar with it. Some of you might not. It's called Hillel and the Chimney. And it's from the Babylonian Talmud. I will read it in English, so I encourage you to go back and forth between the Hebrew and English if you'd like. And this is Hillel, the big one we all talk about. They say about Hillel the elder that every day he would give a trefek, or that he would earn a trefek, a coin, half of which he gave to the guard at the Beit Midrash, and half he used to support himself and his family. One day he earned nothing, and the guard would not let him in. He climbed up and sat on the chimney so that he could hear the words of the living God from Shammai and Avtalion, two rabbis at the time. It happened that it was a Friday around the month of Tevet, and the snow from the heavens fell upon him. At the break of dawn, Shammai said to Avtalion, "My brother, usually it is light, but today it is dark. Perhaps the day is cloudy." They looked up and saw the shape of a man against the chimney, and they found 3 cubits of snow upon him. That's like 5 feet. They took off the snow, washed him, anointed him, and put him by the fire. They said, "For this it is worthy to profane the Shabbat." Now, when I teach a story, I don't like just to read it and share my own thoughts and opinions. I like to open it up for discussion. So, I mean, when I like to study a text, the first thing that I like to do is ask questions. I think it's the most Jewish thing to do, and it's what my parents raised me to. Ask questions, challenge it. So if anybody has any questions, technical, rhetorical, about the text they want to raise, feel free. Otherwise, I'll just ask my own.
The conference has been unmuted.
Elliot, why do you think it is that Hillel is not inside the yeshiva? Why is he upstairs, like on the chimney, listening from outside? Shouldn't Hillel be a sort of important guy?
Wait, just repeat the question. I had trouble hearing.
I'm wondering why it is that Hillel is not inside the yeshiva. You know, he's kind of I guess he became kind of an important guy later, so you would imagine that he'd be worthy to sit inside the room. And so why is he upstairs at the chimney instead of inside?
Excellent, excellent question. I mean, so it would seem, first of all, that at the least when this story takes place, he wasn't yet such a big shot. So they didn't automatically let him in. That would be the assumption. At the same time, one could interpret it otherwise and say, maybe he already was a big shot, but because he couldn't pay and he didn't have a lot of money, they still won't let him in. No matter who you are, if you can't pay, they get you in. I like the first interpretation better. I think it makes more sense. But I think it's troubling either way, right? First of all, like, I want to pay to study Torah. I mean, I guess as somebody who runs a nonprofit, you know, you need money to run, you know, to run the place. But, you know, he's a person who's been coming every day to the Beit Midrash, and one day he doesn't have a coin, and half a coin, the guard doesn't let him in. We have a question here. Was he bribing the guard, or was there an entrance fee? You know, you're not the first person to ask that, Linda. That's a great question. I always thought it was an entrance fee until somebody actually asked me that question last time I taught the story a couple of months ago. I think it was an entrance fee. I think we just understood that this is the price of entering the Beit Midrash. But I think it's a perfectly legitimate interpretation that he was just a nobody who wanted to learn some Torah, so he would bribe the guard to let him in. But in any case, there's something problematic here, that they wouldn't let him in. Not only did they not let him in, it was a cold day, and he really wanted to learn, and he went up on the roof and almost froze himself to death just trying to learn some Torah. Other questions? Problems with the text?
The lines are all unmuted at the moment. Feel free to speak up.
What was that?
Well, it's very Santa-esque this time of year around Christmas time with chimneys and Santa Claus coming down. Interesting it was a Friday and you know, and it's cold and he's up there on the roof, and then the next day is Shabbat, and you can profane, you can do this work on Shabbat because of, you know, is it to save a life? Is it because he was a studier? You know, interesting.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting kind of conflated here. First of all, it's a very fairy tale-esque story. It's almost as if it's told in a way that we aren't supposed to believe or ask whether it's true or not. But the timing is so interesting, right? It's Tevet. First of all, we just enter the month of Tevet now. So shortly after Hanukkah, I guess. The darkest, coldest days of the year. This is on a Friday, and he must have stayed overnight, and they come back to the Beit Midrash on Shabbat morning. Now, one question that is often asked is, what about his family? Right? Remember, every day he would give half of half the coin to the Beit Midrash and half the coin to his family. What was his family doing for a Friday night dinner while he was sitting up on the roof trying to listen to some Torah? That would be, you know, I think a very good feminist critique or just a general question of the story. You know, when is our allegiance to Torah and the house of study or the university, and where is our loyalty and responsibility to our family at home? You know, what's more important, our Torah or our home? But some more questions. Isn't there a similar story of someone falling through the roof? I'm not familiar with such a story. I think maybe that was in the Sword and the Stone, but there might be. There are actually a lot of roof stories in the Talmud. It seems that the smoke from the chimney may have overcome him. Ha, interesting idea. What it seems, though, what's interesting is that Shemayin Avtalion didn't notice that he was missing. This guy who used to come every day, they didn't notice until their studying was affected, until there was a shadow and they had trouble reading the text on the page. How often do we get so involved in our learning and our Torah study that we don't notice the people and the human suffering around us until it affects us? What does it take for us to open our eyes and see the people around us? You know, and so at the end, they bring him in, they light a fire, they break Shabbat, they help him, they warm him up, and they say, for this it is worthy to profane the Shabbat, which is a lovely little statement. At the same time, I learned in my family, well, and from Judaism, that Pikuach Nefesh always puts off the Shabbat for any human being, whether they're holy or not, or whether they're learned or not, it's worthy to profane Shabbat for them. Because human beings, human life comes before Torah. So there are a lot of different messages from this story, a lot of different questions and places that you can go, but one main message, a few main messages that I take out of it, is first of all, who does Torah belong to, right? Torah belongs to all of us, not just the people who can pay, not just the big scholars, but anybody who wants to learn should have a right or part or an ownership to Torah. Those of us who are in positions of power, who are educators, who are learned, and or have the money to afford education, also have a responsibility for those who are in the margins. And so the... you know, the two main messages I take out of this are, first of all, the democratization of Torah. The Torah belongs to all of us. No one is more worthy. And second of all, that study of Torah should never be separated from reality and human needs. And I think those are some of the, you know, main messages that are coming out of this secular Jewish renewal and renaissance happening now in Israel. That Torah belongs to all of us. Maybe we keep mitzvot, maybe we don't, maybe we're kippahs, maybe we don't, maybe we keep Shabbat, maybe we don't. But we're Jews, and we want to learn, and we have a right to learn. We have a right to say, and to understand, and to interpret Torah, and say this is what it means, and this is what it means to be a Jewish state. And at the same time, I think we can't talk about Torah without talking about social justice. And that's something that, you know, I think that's benign. And the kibbutz movement are adding to the voice, as well as the reform movement. You can't talk about Judaism and Jewish pluralism without talking about social justice and social action. I think an interesting phenomenon in Israel is a lot of people really who don't necessarily connect to Judaism as a religion might connect to Jewish values and Israeli values of social action. And I think the combination of pluralistic Judaism, where Judaism isn't just a place where we pray one day a week, but Judaism is how we interact with the world 7 days a week, how we give back, how we serve our community, how we make Israel better, volunteering in my community and volunteering with the African refugees in South Tel Aviv and volunteering with the elderly and bringing you know, human rights and democracy to Israel is a Jewish act and a Jewish thing. So I think we've accomplished a lot in the last 65 years of Israel's history, and a lot in really just the past few years in Israel. Binah and the Reform Movement, I think all the different organizations together that are working together more and more. And just a little bit of shameless self-promotion. Well, we have a lot more to go, and we would love for you guys to come be a part of it. If you know any young people who would like to come to Israel, we have a gap year program for those right after high school. We have Tikkun Olam program for those 21 to 31 to spend half a year in Israel. We just announced a program specifically for clergy and professionals who want to spend 2 weeks this summer studying Jewish sources and social Tel Aviv. And we also run tours and seminars, bringing a congregational trip or any group trip to Israel, you know, either for a pluralistic text study or come visit South Tel Aviv or Jaffa and talk about social issues and economic issues in Israel through a Jewish lens. And always not speaking towards the United States, for example, our beloved teacher and Israeli scholar, educator, Dov Elboim, who just published his first book in English to the U.S. in a few months. If you want to bring him to your synagogue, let me know. So thank you very much. David, do you have any other comments, questions, conclusions?
Can you push one more slide forward?
Yeah.
There
we go. Very nice.
Look at that. So just as a reminder that registration for our convention has been open for a while and is still open, it only takes putting down $500 at this point to make your commitment to come and be with us and to meet Elliot in person and to learn with him and with some of the teachers at BINA and some of the participants at BINA. And it's going to be a really exciting program. And this is the first of our convention previews. There's going to be another bunch of them as we go through the year on our way towards Israel. So please do register so that we can start knowing that you're coming and getting you involved in more parts of this convention. I think that what Elliot has been talking about today is some of the most important things that are going on in Israel and that are actually the greatest ray of hope for us as American Jews and sort of a revitalization of what we need to know. And what the sort of Judaism that we actually are going to be able to live moving into the future. The combination of what we do and what Elliot and his colleagues in Israel do is exciting and is actually something new. And newness is worth a lot to me, at least. And it is only through us going to Israel and seeing it in person that we're really going to find out what is going on with that. So I want to thank you, Elliot, for taking the time to put together this great presentation for us. And I assure you that many of our participants, both today on the phone net right now, and also people who are coming on, going to watch this on their own time later, are going to learn a lot and benefit and come to Israel more prepared and more ready to meet you and to continue this great discussion.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Okay. Elliot's email is there, and you can find him easily. If you have further questions for him, you can always find me if you have more questions for me about our Israel convention. Special thanks to David Reinwald for helping make this webinar possible for all of us. A happy last day of Hanukkah to everyone, and I look forward to talking to you all soon.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your patience.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Please stand by.